From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, a judge rules to halt key parts of HB 2, the new anti-abortion law. Then the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals reverses part of that ruling.
We're very pleased with the way that the Fifth Circuit ruled.
Brownsville, Texas is singled out as the poorest city in America. How the community is embracing that distinction.
We use the data as a flashlight rather than as a club. This can be a very positive thing for our area.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. A new Texas abortion restriction is back to being law after a ruling by a panel of judges with the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans. The decision Thursday requires that doctors performing abortions have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of the clinic where they're working. It was stricken down as unconstitutional earlier this week by federal Judge Lee Yackel. Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott had made an emergency appeal to the conservative Fifth Circuit, arguing that the law requiring doctors to have admitting privileges is a constitutional use of the legislature's authority. Abbott said in a statement that this unanimous decision is a vindication of the careful deliberation by the Texas legislature to craft a law to protect the health and safety of Texas women. But again, this is not the final decision. The court's order is temporary until it can hold a complete hearing, likely in January. Planned Parenthood is moving ahead with a lawsuit against that restrictive abortion requirement. In a statement, Planned Parenthood said the appeals court decision means abortion will no longer be available in vast stretches of Texas. For more reaction, we turn to Joe Poyment, Executive Director of Texas Alliance for Life.
We're pleased that the appellate court in New Orleans is allowing the two challenge provisions in House Bill 2 to go into effect. This is a huge victory, and it's a hard-fought victory, and we believe it's a very good victory because, finally, these increased health standards will not go into effect. We are amazed that abortion facilities have been operating for years without requiring a physician to have privileges at a local hospital. We think that's a common-sense measure because we think a physician should be able to follow his or her patient to a hospital for further treatment after a severe complication from abortion. We also agree with the court that RU 46, the abortion pill, ought to be administered according to the FDA protocol and that physicians should be present when those pills are given to women.
So the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed both of the rulings that the judge did in Austin on Monday.
Correct. It was the three-judge panel unanimously reversed ruling by Judge Yackel, which struck down in total one of the provisions, the provision requiring that physicians have privileges at a local hospital. And it also basically upheld his ruling that said that the FDA protocol must be followed. But it clarified that so that there's only a very narrow exception for cases when a woman is not able to get a surgical abortion and can only have get a medication abortion.
This is not the final decision. We're going to have a hearing on this probably in January. And do you think that although this is a this ruling that we got from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is pretty much showing their hand and where they are on this?
Well, the opinion says that it's likely that the state would prevail on these points of law. And I think that's a very good sign. The court did say that the oral argument will be in January. So that means, I think from both sides, it's important to get this get a decision very quickly, relatively quickly. In the meantime, these common sense measures are now in effect. And we think that that's a very good thing for the from the point of view of allowing the state to pursue its interest in protecting the health and safety of women who are considering abortion.
Tell me again how this protects the health and safety of women, because this basically what it does, it shuts down abortion clinics.
Well, we don't know how if that's the case or not.
Well, we know. But what it, we know.
Well, what it does is
I mean, they're shutting. They're not functioning. They will not be functioning. that doctors will not get that admitting privileges who perform abortions?
Well, according to the plaintiff's own admission, two-thirds of the abortion facilities in Texas do have physicians that have hospital privileges. And I guess our question is, the other third, why didn't they get on the program for all these years and have physicians who do have privileges at a local hospital? We point out that it's against federal and state law for hospitals to discriminate against doctors who do abortions when granting privileges. They grant privileges on other reasons, but not because a doctor performs abortions at other sites. The state's arguments pointed out that at least 90% of women who might be considering abortion are within 100 miles of a facility that does have a doctor with privileges. So this is not about limiting abortion. This is about increasing safety standards for those abortions that do go on.
And you're mainly concerned with abortion safety and not other medical procedures safety.
Well, what this does is bring the abortion procedures, the safety standards for abortion procedures, up to the level of comparable facilities and safety standards. For example, a physician that performs a procedure called a dilation and curettage after a woman has a miscarriage, that's probably or almost certainly going to be done in an ambulatory surgical center or a hospital, not an abortion facility, because of the higher standards for the operating rooms at those facilities, the ambulatory surgical center or a hospital. That physician almost certainly is going to have privileges at a local hospital. We heard testimony when the bill was being debated that that is just the standard of care. Why these abortion facilities have been operating at a lower standard is really pretty amazing to us, because they've been operating all these years. And I guess that's probably why the legislature did pass this law last summer by very wide margins, and the governor was happy to sign it.
I mean, it was passed on along party lines, pretty much. There were some Democrats who were pro-life who also went along with it, but it was seen as an effort to make attaining an abortion more difficult. And this is a good argument that you guys make, but it's really about trying to keep women from having abortions.
Yeah, I think the best way to describe this bill is what motivates it is to increase the safety standards at abortion facilities to the level of comparable medical and surgical facilities.
So when people say this really is about a pro-life movement that has a religious basis for trying to prevent women from having abortions, that's not true.
Well, they probably haven't read the mission statement for Texas Alliance for Life, because we're a non-sectarian, non-partisan organization. We do think that so our motivation is to protect unborn babies from conception and natural death, but also to protect mothers who are undergoing abortion. And I point out that the Supreme Court is very clear that states may not ban most abortions, but the states can regulate abortions for interests, for reasons of increasing informed consent, or for ensuring that parents are involved in the abortion decision, or for regulating abortion facilities to assure that the safety standards are adequate. And that's what I think the Fifth Circuit is allowing Texas to do.
The admitting privileges is what this is centering on right now. If a doctor does not have admitting privileges to a hospital, that means what? He can't go in the hospital? He can't do what?
Yeah, the hospital has not granted him privileges to practice medicine in that hospital.
So he can't be there?
He cannot treat his patients at that hospital.
And that's what happens normally. If I have to go to the hospital, my general practitioner is going to be there while they're doing surgery on me, or what?
Well, the physician can, if your physician, if he or she has privileges at a local hospital, he or she can practice medicine on that hospital. The hospital assumes the liability risk, and that allows the physician to treat you in the hospital.
If you go to the hospital and you have some surgery performed on you, open heart surgery, your general practitioner, your family doctor, he's not going to be in the surgery. He's not going to be waiting for you to come out of surgery.
Well, I think any woman who sees an obstetrician in his or her office will then expect that doctor to come to the hospital to deliver the baby, and that's typically what happens. The reason that's possible is that that physician has privileges at the hospital.
So do we require all doctors to have admitting privileges within 30 miles of where they're practicing?
I think the ambulatory surgical centers, which are comparable, you know, day surgeries, they have a provision which is very similar. And that provision says that all the physicians at the ambulatory surgical center have to have privileges, or they have to have some type of transfer agreement with other physicians.
But not all doctors. I mean, if there's a doctor in town, he's a general practitioner, he's a family doctor, but he's not required to have admitting privileges at a hospital.
I don't know how to answer that question. I'm not sure. I'm going to have to.
So some doctors don't. Some doctors, they're able to practice medicine, but they don't have to have admitting privileges. But you're saying that these abortion doctors do.
Yes, and
so why not? Why not pass a law saying all doctors should have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of where they practice? That would increase safety.
One thing is the type of procedure that's being done.
Well, they do lots of procedures. Lots of doctors do lots of procedures. So if this is such a good idea, let's do it for all doctors.
Well, as I said, in a comparable day surgery center, like an ambulatory surgical center, I think that's typically the case at the physicians.
But right now you guys you're celebrating, you're thrilled with the way things are working out with this law?
We're very pleased with the way the Fifth Circuit ruled.
What's next?
Well, we're interested to see how well the Department of State Health Services implements this and enforces this law. While we wait for the oral argument in January before the Third Court of Appeals, and then we'll be waiting to see how that court rules, whether they rule that the law can be fully enforced on a permanent basis.
Joe Poyman is the executive director for Texas Alliance for Life. He is celebrating the Thursday ruling from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals that negates part of Monday's abortion court ruling. The ups and downs of the oil industry have written the history of the Permian Basin in West Texas. Today, the basin is in hyper-expansion mode. The federal government said this week that the region is now the nation's largest oil production center. An oil and gas boom means even roughnecks can make $100,000 a year. Lauren Madelon reports.
3 decades after the last boom and bust, fracking and horizontal drilling allow extraction of once inaccessible oil and gas. There are proven reserves predicted to last several decades, and right now the basin is jammed. Here are three oil field workers, Dave Cronwell, Frank McCoy, and Darnell Joyson.
Everybody's here for the money.
The reason I came out here is for the money.
Make money, the boom. I mean, everybody is out here making money.
The city of Odessa's issued 572 permits for new housing in the last year. Normally that number is 50. Third-rate motels cost $200 a night, and you're lucky if you find a room.
We've got two oil field supply companies back in there.
Guy Andrews is the economic development director at the Odessa Chamber of Commerce.
Union Pacific's about to put in a big rail yard out here on 200 and something acres.
He's driving by once empty flatlands, transformed into a nest of construction cranes.
This has grown great, gone crazy.
Oil rigs operating 24/7, the sound of money. Sales tax revenue in Midland went from $13 million in 2001 to $29 million in 2011. Some analysts say that production will remain viable even if the cost of crude falls to $50 or $60 a barrel. Right now, it's around $98. Akinrin Made is a petroleum engineer from Nigeria.
I've been in Odessa almost a year now.
The Niger Delta of Nigeria is a crucible of oil extraction with plenty of work to go around. But Made accepted an invitation to come here to West Texas.
A lot of people will be relocating over here now because of the job. But the other thing that is really, really tough is housing. You find it difficult to get a living area. And if you can get one, it's very expensive.
Oilfield supervisor Charles Moody worked previously in the oil fields of North Dakota and East Texas. In East Texas, he had a 5-bedroom, 3-bath house for $800 a month.
They're wanting me to move here. And just looking here, you know, there's 1-bedroom, 1-bath homes for $1,800 a month already.
Cesar Favela drives an oil truck in Odessa.
You're not there for Father's Day, you're not there for Christmas sometimes, you know, and for the delivery of my kids, you know, sometimes you gotta miss it, and that's all part of the work.
He's away from home in El Paso for months at a time.
I do hate being away from my family, but it's good money. You know, I got a nice house for them. They dress nice and, you know, the whole thing. You know.
Radio ads tell injured workers that lawyers can visit them at home or the hospital. It's not that the oil fields are less safe, but traffic tells the story here. Arrive at midnight and it feels like rush hour. You see ambulances whipping by all the time. You're 12 times more likely than the national average to be in a traffic accident here. Catastrophic busts have often followed booms. Betsy Donaldson owns a small restaurant.
You know, it's nice having a lot of people around. It's nice having new businesses and things. But it's tough because I know it's not forever. You know, it will go away. Everybody's house values will drop. And they'll still be paying mortgages that are really, really high for values for houses they can't sell. And so this is what's going to happen. You know, it's just a matter of time.
That said, some heavy hitters are betting this boom's different. Royal Dutch Shell is scouting property, and Halliburton, Apache, and Flint Hills Resources, owned by Charles and David Koch, are just three of the major corporations already here. I'm Lorne Madelon in Odessa, Texas.
Statistics from the Census Bureau names the border city of Brownsville, Texas, as the poorest city in the United States, and the nearby city of McAllen was ranked third poorest. Of the 415,000 residents of the Brownsville statistical area, 36% live below the poverty line. That's a family of four earning less than $23,000 a year. Brownsville's rate is more than twice the national average of 16%, and for Texas, it's 17%. Tracy Wickett is president of the United Way of Southern Cameron County, which covers Brownsville.
I think what it means is that there's now more of a spotlight on the area. It's not that things have changed so radically in the Brownsville-Harlingen area, but now we're sort of under the microscope. And so I think that what it might do is help lift up some of the strategies that we're using to boost financial stability and maybe put some of the work more in the eyes of funders. There's a lot of people doing amazing work here to reverse this trend. Everything from ensuring that kids are ready to succeed when they start school to really robust efforts to boost access to the earned income tax credit, which brings in more than $2 million into our community every year. So I think if we look at this as an opportunity, if we use the data as a flashlight rather than as a club, this can be a very positive thing for our area.
We need to go further down that road. So how can it be a positive thing just so that you can draw attention to it and maybe find some real long-term solutions? Is that what you're saying?
I think absolutely that data can be used in a really positive way. Data is what it is. And we're going to use the fact that we've risen to the top of this list in the most positive way possible. If it helps us attract the attention of funders who are looking to bring about great change in communities where it's needed most, then that'll be a wonderful thing. We've always maintained that the border can be a learning lab for the rest of the nation, that what's happening in the border today is what's going to be happening in Austin in 5 years and in Omaha in 10. Let's learn lessons about how we reverse these trends. Let's use the border as a petri dish and figure out what really works to change these conditions. How do we fix poverty? And I think we have a great opportunity to demonstrate really promising practices for that.
Looking back in 2006, the poverty rate in Brownsville was 42%. So there is some positiveness there, right?
There definitely is lift. There's no doubt that there's lift. And they say a rising tide lifts all boats, and I think we're rising along with that tide. But 36% is unacceptable. And the thing to remember about this data is that it's not just Brownsville. This is the Brownsville-Harlingen MSA. Harlingen is more well-to-do than Brownsville. So if we disaggregate the data and separate out Brownsville alone, it looks even worse than this. our mission is to concentrate on the areas of deepest poverty. And so we will concentrate on Brownsville, on Los Fresnos, on Port Isabel, and work to develop strategies and roll them out and measure them to see if there's something we can do about this. If we can decrease the poverty rate here, then those strategies can be translated across the nation.
What is it about Brownsville that makes it so poor?
We have extremely low educational attainment. We're also a very, very young population. So if you look at the demographics for our community, we're young and we're undereducated in addition to being poor. At one point, we may still be number one on the list of the highest percentage of children in poverty at 53.1%. We know that poor children start school behind their wealthier peers. We know that if we don't increase our educational attainment, breaking this cycle of poverty is going to be a very difficult task. And so we're working hard. In fact, we have a goal in our community to double the number of young adults with post-secondary credentials with labor market value by the year 2025. We think that's our best bet out of poverty.
A lot of people think, well, it's on the border. That's why it's so poor. There's a reason because it's so close to Mexico.
I think that communities with a high percentage of new immigrants will see something happen to their poverty rate. But to say that because we're on the border, we can't flourish would be to accept defeat. And we can't do that. I don't care if you've been here 10 days or 10 years. You need the opportunity to realize the American dream. We can't give up on that just because someone hasn't been here for generations.
It's also an agricultural community.
Less and less all the time. We were actually a pretty decent manufacturing community for a while until manufacturing moved first to Mexico and then to China. We are trying to find our niche, but instead of playing the chicken and egg game of, well, we can't get jobs because we don't have an educated workforce and we can't educate people for jobs that don't exist, we're moving ahead with educating people for jobs that don't exist.
So what do you say to people who just want to write Brownsville off as a black hole of poverty at the very bottom tip of Texas, that nothing can be done to change that?
If you don't think anything can be done to change conditions in Brownsville, Texas, you have never been to Brownsville, Texas, or met the people here who are so incredibly determined to work together to change community conditions. The fabric of this community in Brownsville is La Familia. We know about working together because our strongest cultural imperative is the strength of the family, and that puts us in a position to form strong, enduring partnerships that will march together through good times and bad to change community conditions. It's just in our DNA to work together. And I happen to think that that's the way we're going to pull ourselves out of this hole, is by everybody holding hands and pulling each other up. We're not going to be crabs in the bucket pulling down the ones who are successful. We're going to be pushing people up out of the bucket.
Tracy Wickett is the president of United Way of Southern Cameron County, which serves the Brownsville area. Brownsville was named this week as the poorest city in the United States. Many residents of the Mexican border city of Juarez, across from El Paso, are eager to say goodbye to one of the bloodiest eras in the city's history. Juarez was the epicenter of a vicious drug war that resulted in the deaths of more than 10,000 people. Now things are improving, but echoes of the violence remains, particularly in the most marginalized communities. Monica Ortiz Uribe reports on one neighborhood's effort to look after its young people.
It's the dawn of a new day in Ciudad Juarez. The new mayor was sworn into office just 3 weeks ago. In his inaugural speech, Enrique Serrano stressed that the city will no longer be distracted by bullets.
Ya pasó la tormenta y se plantea un futuro promisorio para Juárez.
The storm is behind us now, he says, and Juárez has a promising future ahead. Indeed, much of Juárez is breathing a sigh of relief. The murder rate back in 2010 averaged 8 people a day. Now it's less than 2 per day. Local police have reduced the number of kidnappings and car thefts. Once abandoned sections of the city are now alive with new businesses. But by no means is Juarez absolved of its violent past. On the far west side of the city lies a collection of former squatter communities known as Anapra. Drive down one of the few paved roads here, and instead of sidewalks, you'll see margins of golden desert sand littered with potato chip bags and threadbare socks. Women push rickety strollers and lug grocery bags across a treeless terrain. This place is notorious as a birthplace of cartel hitmen.
Mira, mi nombre es María de Lourdes Contreras Castañeda.
Anapra is a place of little opportunity. Rampant poverty accommodates the presence of organized crime here. A year ago, 46-year-old Lourdes Contreras, a product of these streets herself, decided to open up a study center for troubled youth. It's called Los Soles, named after the sun in the sky. Inside, children sit at a tiny table scribbling with markers. Others practice multiplication tables. And in the kitchen, a volunteer mother heats up tortillas for lunch. As many as 70 kids can come through here in a day.
Hijos de drogadictos, de prostitutas.
These are the children left behind by the violence, Contreras says. They are the children of addicts, prostitutes, and smugglers, she says. Many were abandoned and abused. In some of their notebooks, they draw pictures of bleeding hearts and stick figures shooting bullets from a car. One of the more extreme cases is that of 4-year-old Kimberly Torres. In an interview, she innocently offers fragments of the horror she lived. Her story was pieced together by police and her grandmother. Kimberly witnessed the murder of her parents earlier this year. They were found tortured and bound inside their home. Kimberly spent the night hugging their corpses. In the morning, she turned up at her grandma's house, soaked in their blood.
Están en el cielo.
Now, she says, my parents are in heaven.
Jugaremos en el bosque.
Outside the study center, some girls play a sing-along game. Los Soles survives off donations and fundraising. When drug violence in Juarez reached its peak, the federal government invested $250 million to support violence prevention programs like this. But that money has mostly run out. Howard Campbell is an anthropology professor in neighboring El Paso.
The problems of Juarez, the longstanding problems of poverty, lack of opportunity, poor schools, remain and are only improved by the actual efforts of private citizens themselves.
There's only so much the volunteers at Los Soles can do. Most are mothers and grandmothers who never finish school. They help the kids with their homework, provide a little food, and encourage them to stay out of trouble. But the odds are against them. As long as there's profit to be made smuggling people and drugs across the border, these children will continue to be courted by organized crime.
And consequently, you have fertile ground for another round of violence and social problems in Juarez.
For now, the people of Anapra are enjoying a tenuous peace, while the volunteers at Los Soles work in hopes of a better tomorrow. Reporting from Ciudad Juarez, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. Or you can comment on our website at tpr.org. And there are past Texas Matters programs there you can also listen to. And you can check us out on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.